You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Philippa Cordingley from the Chief Executive of the Centre for the Use of Research and Evidence in Education. I'm really delighted to welcome you all to this lunchtime event. So it's my very great pleasure to introduce this afternoon's guest speaker, Dr. Kevin Collins, who's Chief Executive of the Educational Endowment Foundation. Kevin's been working in public service for over 25 years and was fundamental in the primary national strategies and Chief Executive in the London Borough of Tower Hamlets, and has done an awful lot of very distinguished but also very practical things in education. Kevin's going to help us think about these issues by describing how evidence can inform education practice and help to improve pupil outcomes and establish, in particular, new levels of professional trust and knowledge. How good would that be? This afternoon's event is running alongside and scheduled in conjunction with a rather wonderful activity organised by the RSA and the PEARS Foundation, which is a day symposium exploring an evidence-based approach in the specific context of Holocaust education, which turns out to have many very fruitful and important challenges and rich opportunities embedded within it for engaging with evidence. And this partnership marks the launch of the Institute of, of Education Research into secondary school students' knowledge and understanding of the Holocaust. So it's a middle, and it's a beginning also of a day. And before we hear from Kevin, I'm delighted to start off the proceedings by welcoming Ruth Ann Lenger, who's going to give a brief introduction so you get a flavour of the research too. And Ruth Ann is Head of Academic Programmes at the Institute of Education's Centre for Holocaust Education. So over to you, Ruth Ann.
Thank you very much, Philippa, for that. Yes, earlier today, the UCL Centre for Holocaust Education launched findings of its most recent research study, which sought to discover what young people in secondary schools in England know, understand, and think about the Holocaust. Our researchers conducted an extensive multi-method national survey involving over 90 schools, combining survey responses from almost 8,000 students across a broad demography, with focus group interviews with some 300 students. And a huge amount of data has emerged. The survey alone composed of 91 questions. We shared extracts from the data collected and our tentative interpretations at the RSA PEARS Foundation symposium this morning with lead practitioners of Holocaust education, so that as a collective, we could begin the vital task of making sense of these findings, of asking ourselves critical questions, hopefully the right questions, about our teaching of the Holocaust in the light of this new knowledge. And we also hope to look to the future. We are committed to the idea that this won't be done quickly on the back of an envelope. Rather, it will be an ongoing process of development, which has to be conducted in a spirit of collaboration and reflection of all stakeholders in the field of Holocaust education. Our latest research, together with the findings of an earlier study we conducted on a sample of 2,000 teachers on their teaching of the Holocaust, is unprecedented in its scope and scale. It may surprise you that despite the gravity of the subject's content, its established compulsory place on the history national curriculum and the establishment of the National Holocaust Memorial Day fixed into our calendar, precious little was previously known about what goes on in schools regarding teaching and learning about the Holocaust. What challenges do teachers face when they approach this subject? What knowledge do they have? What training do they receive? And what do young people make of this heavy and deeply disturbing history? Large empirical studies on a national scale just don't exist anywhere in the world. So the centre is very conscious of the importance of the data it holds on behalf of the community and the value that it will have to teachers, policymakers, teacher trainers, and ultimately to the quality of provision for Holocaust education offered to young people in the future. Now, I realise that some of you in the audience may not be teachers, but I'm sure that you could appreciate that to teach and to learn the Holocaust is a complex and challenging endeavour. Much is at stake when subjects that hold such a traumatic past disturb the senses and question ideas about what it means to be human. Concerns and anxieties abound. Whilst our research found that young people tend to be very interested in the Holocaust and see it as having a very high importance in their education, there does appear to be some worrying gaps in knowledge and understanding. Some oversimplistic ideas have formed and misconceptions exist. For example, the majority of young people in our sample perceived that Hitler alone or Hitler and the Nazis were solely responsible for the Holocaust. Now, this raises questions for us to consider as to the possible consequence for learning if young people do not fully grasp the crucial issues of individual, societal, responsibility, agency, and choice. So it was these sorts of questions that we were grappling with this morning, and the sort of questions that our research raises for us. We hope at the Centre for Holocaust Education to be designing even more programmes for CPD, continuing professional development for teachers, in the light of the findings and the interpretations that we are building, and that we will be able to offer that free of charge to teachers across the country. Building a strong relationship between research and practice for effective and quality engagement in education is something that Philippa and Kevin argue for. And we are very much looking forward to hearing Kevin share his vision and ideas on this important dynamic. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much indeed. I hope you're all kind of now poised to get on the internet and dig into the research, those of you who haven't had the fortune to be with us this morning. And now it's my great pleasure to introduce Kevin, who brings actually a wonderful combination of passion about learning, about young people, about teachers, and about success, together with a forensic and incisive determination about quality underneath it. Kevin, over to you.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you very, very much for inviting me to join this day. To encourage you to kind of participate, so I might say some things which are slightly contentious. I want to pick up on Ruth Ann's point and take for as given that the study of the Holocaust is vital and fundamental to any child's education. And yet suggests that when you look at the survey, and I'll return to the survey later on, there are some indications that perhaps we're not teaching it as well as we might. We're not teaching it as deeply as we might. And that is important. I want to reflect on Holocaust education as being vital, but suggest that we need to do more if we want to go further than just cover the content. The Centre for Holocaust Education, and I do recommend the reports, both the 2009 and the recent one, I think it's terrific work, and building that evidence base is so fundamental. Recommend in 2009 in that report that we need to better align what teachers know with the development of teaching. And quite a lot of my talk is going to be about this relationship between content and teaching and how we have to think about those two things in tandem. The call for improved subject knowledge, which I'm sure and is correct is weakening too many teachers about the subject for a whole set of very interesting reasons we could go into, but I don't think we've got time, was set alongside the need to support stimulating critical discussion. So here you have vital, important, relevant, and deep content that creates great opportunities for deep learning and really powerful teaching, but isn't being necessarily used in that way. Alice Pettigrew, I don't know if Alice is in the audience, who works at the Institute in the team, wrote a really fascinating paper for me. And there's a great quote, which I'll just read out to you. My point being that there is an important opportunity here to really interrogate what students and their teachers know or don't know, feel or believe about the Holocaust, and to use that information as a baseline for deliberation on critically important questions that have remained unanswered throughout its formal history in the curriculum. What is Holocaust education actually for? She ends the quote. Well, to answer that question, I'll turn to another member of that team who puts it far better than I can, in Paul Sammons. You can't interpret the world without an understanding of the Holocaust. So here we have it. We have a vital piece of knowledge that is about children interpreting the world as it is, and yet we're not necessarily and reliably using that knowledge to support great teaching. That's going to be my main sort of thrust. So the evidence indicates that we're not going deep. We're not engaging with the subject in ways that give children the chance to, in Paul's words, interpret their world, which in many ways you could argue is more important today than it's been for many, many years. But you need to understand the history in order to understand the present and the future. Now, this is because, in my view, content doesn't stand alone. No matter how powerful, how important, how relevant, in every classroom, content sits in a holy trinity with three other fundamental relationships: how we teach, what we teach, and the kind of place we create. For those that know their education history, that's a paraphrase of Dewey, who always used to argue that a school is basically three things: what you teach, how you teach, the kind of place you are. Today, I'm going to spend time on the second, how we teach, although the one that I'm passionate about is the kind of place we are. But I want to talk about how we teach and why it is that with this fantastically rich and important and vital content, we still find it hard to teach in a way which promotes and builds the kind of interpretation, the kind of critical reflection inquiry we want to see in children. Now, my evidence for that point, by the way, comes back to the survey, that when you look at the way that children answered some of the vital questions, what happened if you wouldn't participate, who was responsible, what percentage of people in Germany were Jewish, all these questions revealed, in some ways, a sad and unfortunate failure to really understand important and vital facts. And I'm going to suggest that's about the way the knowledge was taught. So three propositions as I go forward. How to teach is every bit as important as what we teach. We need to apply more reliably what we know about effective teaching if we're going to make any teaching, this or any other teaching, memorable, which is the task. What we know about effective, we know much more about effective teaching than we think we do. But there, for a whole set of reasons around ideology and the denuding the professions of teachers in this country, that knowledge isn't accessible and hasn't been made available to teachers in their practice. Teaching has not, unfortunately, evolved today in England as an evidence-based profession. That's to the detriment of everybody, children and teachers and our nation. And finally, the third proposition is going to be that evidence doesn't stand alone. No good just citing the evidence, because evidence on its own doesn't make a difference. It's got to be mobilised with the right kind of incentives and challenges that demand and support its application. Let me just run through those very quickly. Let's begin by touching on the relationship about how you teach and what you teach. This kind of pedagogy versus content. An arid sort of contest, because it's not about one or the other, it's about both, but about how they sit together. How is it you progress from your first day of teaching? And you always kind of go back to that, I do, quite often when I think about discussions like this. Anxious, in that classroom, you're in the kind of, you're locked in a sort of fight or flight mode as you wait for these 30 people to try and do damage to you. You sit in the classroom and you're trying to, how do you move from that to create these incredible places that you go and observe where powerful, important content is being explored in magical ways? When you observe great teachers, and many of you are great teachers, you will observe them. If you haven't, it's a wonder you should all go and see. It's better than any blockbuster in my view. When you watch a great teacher in motion, it's the orchestration of skills, the knowledge as they exemplify, as they probe, as they respond to children, as they work at different levels, as they deal with the emotional as well as the content. It is one of the most complex human acts, in my view. It is a marvel to watch a great teacher. And it's tempting when you watch a great teacher to be beguiled and think, well, this is innate. Some are just born to do it. But there's a problem. We need about 400,000 of these magical people. This is one of the few mass professions in any society. And the truth is, of course, that while some people are just good at it, not as many as you think, and they're not usually as good as they think they are either over time, the truth is that teaching, like intelligence, is not fixed. It's malleable. It's within our control. We just have decided for some unknown reason, not to invest in teachers. We don't invest in them getting better. The evidence indicates that actually the first few years of your teaching, because we don't invest in growth, kind of determines the teacher you'll be. And without deliberate action, experience alone won't improve your performance. That's a rub for anyone who's into getting more pay just because you've been there for longer. But you don't actually get better just by being a teacher. The evidence is pretty clear on that. Without attention, teachers are destined to be prisoners of their initial experience. Of all professions, it's ironic that we appear to forego the opportunity to help our teachers learn and improve. We have an industry that's dedicated to rate teachers, constantly weighing the baby. But there's not the same attention to helping them improve. And it's not the same as helping someone to improve just by constantly rating them. And yet, we are fortunate that there's much educational research done by colleagues at UCL and IOE around the world. This is an industry as well of wonderful researchers. It's a studied enterprise. We know a lot about it. The problem is that the knowledge we have just isn't made available to those that do the business. We have enormous data that allows us to compare schools with schools. We do contextual value added. We have this endless obsession with the institution, with the structures, what they're called. Your free school, your academy, your maintained school. We're obsessed with structures. But actually, the evidence is it's not about the structures, it's not about the institutions, it's about the individuals who have relationships with children. Because the evidence for that, of course, is the variation within schools is far greater than the variation between schools. And that's true of all types of schools. So what do we know about teaching? Well, I started teaching in the East End of London. I can see some people here from the East End of London, Derek. 32 years ago in Mile End. And I describe that period of beginning teaching as uninformed professional judgment. Great for me, sorry to the children who were there. I was handed a class of 32 children and basically told, get on with it. This was a period when we were free to bring our own methods, our own approaches to the task. And of course, I'd had 9 months of a PGC. I knew all there was to know about teaching. There were some school-level approaches, but they were the kind of ideologies and the deputy you had at the time had a fixed approach to teaching reading, and did you dare move out? No evidence, it's just her approach. So we had this uninformed professional judgment. It didn't serve our children well, particularly didn't serve the poor children of England well. We mustn't look back through rose-tinted spectacles. The second phase of my own professional life came with the Thatcher era. People remember that. An unprecedented raft of legislation. National curriculum, national testing, league tables, the whole inspection frameworks. By the way, an architecture that hasn't really been dismantled. It is still basically architecture. But much of the content in that period, it wasn't informed by evidence. It was the kind of collective judgment and expertise, so-called, of key politicians and senior advisors. Let's call that period uninformed prescription. So we've moved from uninformed professional judgment. We've now just gone to uninformed prescription. Third phase, New Labour arrives, 1997, 98. Education, education, education. The architecture remains, and people like me are involved with things like the national strategies. We're using some evidence, well, we think we are, to inform these approaches and these systems, but it is prescriptive. I'm going to call that, and I'm being generous to myself now, informed prescription. Now, the fourth phase, and we're on a cusp of a phase. Now the appetite from all the politicians, to a degree, is to step back, embrace a school-led system where autonomous schools are free from the shackles of local bureaucrats like me in local councils and central prescription, and under a belief that the autonomy of individual, of school-led system will improve outcomes for all. The evidence today doesn't yet demonstrate that that's what's happening, although that doesn't mean that the test, the experiment is over. It may well be the answer. But we're on a cusp, and I think the question is straightforward. Do we move back to a phase of uninformed professional judgment as individual schools go their own way with this content or any content, or do we move to a new phase, a kind of a golden phase, you hope, of informed professional judgment? Now, what will make the difference, and this is picking up my second point, why would it be informed professional judgment? It'll be informed professional judgment because people use evidence to make decisions about what they do in their classrooms. And the good news, I think, is that there is a quiet revolution underway. As we know, the best revolutions are quiet. The evidence about what we know in teaching and learning has been assembled. It's been put together by people like John Hattie, like the EEF, with our teaching and learning toolkit. We've assembled what we know. We've learned from around the world and put together 11,000 research studies in an accessible format to say this is the difference, this is what happens, this is the cost, this is the impact, this is the strength of the evidence. The materials begin, they provide a shared platform for the first time to have a different kind of conversation as you're making decisions in your schools about the way you teach this content or other content. And what's good to report is that something like 60% of schools are now using that information. Only last month, 40,000 teachers went to draw on that material to inform some of their decision-making in this country. So we are beginning to see a shift to the evidence. It's about making it available to people. And importantly, we're learning more every day. It's not an evidence that's there. It's an evidence we build. And I think, as the points were raised earlier, we need to know a lot more about this education and this knowledge through evidence as well. We're working with teachers at the EF in every part of England to learn more. Innovations from the classroom up, 100 different studies involving 1 in 5 classroom schools in England, 600,000 children to ask over 100 questions about how do we improve what we do in order to get outcomes for children. But doing it in a different way, doing it in a way that I call disciplined innovation, using randomized control trials, using robust methods to develop our understanding so we can report back on what works. As I say, 1 in 5 schools involved, a quiet revolution. But we can build the evidence, we can assemble it, we can present it on this question and others. But just doing that isn't going to be enough, because evidence doesn't stand on its own 2 feet. Think about what we know about the evidence around exercise, I don't know, diets, the consumptions of red wine. Am I the only person that kind of knows it but doesn't live it? Is it just me or are you? No, I don't think so. We know that living by evidence in our own personal lives is really hard. So why would it be different for teachers? People endlessly talk about medicine being an evidence-informed profession. We know that the simple task of washing your hands turns out to be quite a hard thing to do reliably and relentlessly. So putting these systems and structures and incentives and motivations around practice to employ evidence is every bit as difficult as assembling it. If you return to the 2009 report, and this can be, I think, said for many other bits of change we want to see in classrooms as well, They say responsibility for weaknesses in Holocaust education or any other aspects of learning must be shared by all across the system. And this is true. It's not the individual teacher. It's about the system in which they work that we need to attend just for a moment. Again, the latest report on Holocaust education that released recently, the one that was referenced today, sets out the need to offer teachers an ongoing and research-informed program of professional development. This is an interesting moment to pause. The need for ongoing professional learning isn't restricted to this area. It's a generic and ongoing issue. There was a McKinsey report in 2007 that was classic for McKinsey, a bit of a bulletin from the Ministry of the Obvious, but did say that education system can never be better than the sum of the quality of its teachers. It's great when you hear it, but it's one of those wonderful phrases you wish you'd thought of. It's self-evident. And yet we in England have a haphazard and random approach to teacher development. There are no national expectations on teacher development. There are no obligations. There is no requirement set down about how much teaching and training and development a teacher in their life cycle of teaching must have. It gets worse than that. When you are being trained, the materials you're being trained on and the method of training that you're being subject to, there is no requirement that is proven whatsoever. When you say it like that, it's almost hard to believe. One of the most important features of the future of our country and our economy and we have no standard obligation that how we train this mass profession is proven or is evidence-led. The hope, though, in all of this, I think, lies in the recommendations set out again in the 2009 report. And many of the people here are part of the hope. But it's not yet been fulfilled. And that is that schools learn to work much more closely with lead schools, what you might call beacon schools, in networks of schools. Schools need to learn from each other. Because that's where the capacity now lies within the school system. And it is a battle for capacity. As I conclude, the UCL report reinforces my view that if we want to teach what matters better, if we want to ensure that every child gets their right to a great education, and if we're going to tackle the biggest issue in English education, actually, which is the fantastically shameful gap we have in outcomes for children from disadvantaged families, we need to address just three simple priorities. The first is the trust. We do need to build much more trust at every level of our system. And for the system itself, by demonstrating our professional standing and our acknowledged expertise as being evidence-literate as a profession. The second is wisdom. We need to bring much more knowledge, evidence, and informed judgment. It's not just RCTs, it is informed judgment. It is our wisdom to the system to tackle these deep and intractable problems. We have to teach this knowledge right. We have to teach many things better. There are deep problems that we just aren't solving. The system is not getting better, and it's certainly not getting better fast enough. And thirdly, we need to think about responsibility, which I'm now substituting for accountability. We need to move beyond the confines of accountability frameworks where people are constantly gaming something done to them. And we need to encourage greater personal responsibility. Shared, collective, and personal responsibility to provide the very best education for all of our children. Thank you very much, everybody.
Well, that was terrific, Kevin, and thought-provoking, just as you promised us. One of the things that I've been learning from listening to people this morning and reading my way through the research is one of the ways of getting to this informed, evidence-informed, but also wisdom-informed set of judgments around Holocaust education seems to be when we get schools working together holistically, and when people's desire to learn through the Holocaust is happening through being set in a historical context, that when the facts, when the evidence that comes from the disciplines of historians is put in place, that creates a kind of space and an environment, as you might be describing it, in which the kind of learning you're looking for can happen. And so I've been thinking about the different disciplines that different teachers bring to use research and evidence, the role they've got to play in building the kind of trust you're talking about. And I just was interested in your reflections about, do you think that the scientists have a particular thing to bring, that historians have a particular thing to bring, and that part of the job of bringing research-informed practice to life might be to pay attention to the identities of teachers and what they bring?
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, I keep returning to the word trust, because the best classrooms I see are where people feel confident about roving around sometimes quite sensitive content in a way where they know that they're allowed to ask the questions, they're allowed to go beyond the given, they're allowed to explore in a way that really connects with them personally. And I worry that too much teaching is not focused on building that kind of trust. It's racing through content. We recently did a piece of work on mathematics teaching, which you might think, how does that connect? And we were looking at the way they teach mathematics in Singapore, math mastery, and applying it into English classrooms as a test, a randomized control test. And what was interesting was that when you watch the lessons in math mastery, teachers in that approach have the space and time to go deep, to hold every child in. They won't move on until all the children are moving together. And these are signs of me that we are a community learning together, not one where we're allowed to kind of dump the wounded and move on, and some move on to level six and some are left. You know, there are lots of signals about the way we're organised our education system, which I think children Children are very sensitive to cynicism, and they see a system which I think is gamed sometimes, which is not about looking after everybody, which is not about building places where I'm allowed to ask the questions and talk about it. So I think this is all subjects. I don't think this is any particular subject. I think it's about the nature of the classrooms and places we want to build and create. So I absolutely agree with you that it's all teachers and all subjects.
And might the different subjects have some particular things to contribute
sure,
to that?
Sure, I mean, there's this arid discussion, isn't there, about are we trying to raise standards in literacy and numeracy and, you know, who cares about the, you know, this horrible notion of there being some subjects which have less status than others? I mean, what we know is that a broad and balanced curriculum is fundamental to children's learning. We've just done a piece of work in the OECD, and Joe's here, Joe knows much about this than I do, about arts education. Now, there's not necessarily any strong link between arts education in order to raise attainment, literacy, numeracy. But having said that, how can you be a rounded learner without the skills and opportunities that arts education gives you? So we need to honour some subjects for their own sake, because we're trying to help children to become rounded learners and rounded citizens. So, of course, every subject has a particular contribution to make, and we need to hold on to a broad and balanced curriculum.
Okay. And within that, I think I'm hearing you say absolute and utter clarity about the meaningful purpose, why we're bothering to do any of sure. the things we're doing, brought together with the evidence.
Two things. That purpose, but also whatever we teach, we need to teach it well. There's nothing worse than a poor art lesson. That's the crime, not that someone dumps art off the curriculum. So we need to teach everything well, and we need to understand the value of teaching everything.
Okay. Really, really helpful. Just a different tack before we open this up. Because I think one of the issues, there are so few CPD examples where such care has been taken to build the knowledge and understanding of teachers' starting points before the CPD was designed, and then to work with the evidence through that process. And some new findings we're bringing out next week will reinforce the importance of that. But we've got this wonderful research. It has a lot to speak to Holocaust education. It has a great deal to say to that very important topic of professional learning and investing in that more generally. But the wicked issue around research, as you well know, is dissemination is a bit of a thin concept. It's hard to do, but it's a necessary first step. We need to make this wonderful research reach into the lives of teachers and schools more broadly. So what have you learned, both about what not to do and to do, from your work with the Education Endowment Foundation about getting research into people's lives?
Well, I don't blame the researchers and I don't blame the teachers. I think we've just, the incentives, the horrible language, but the kind of incentives and structures have not at all been motivating anyone to kind of bridge that gap. What we've learned is that you look at the 1 in 5 schools joining us with a trial, you look at the way people have fallen on stuff like the toolkit, your work, Philippa, there's no lack of appetite in the education profession to be research informed. In fact, it's the route to professionalisation. What there is there's an appetite for research, and there is a frustration at interference. So we're trying to tackle the interference by people who are perhaps not informed, but want to constantly interfere in the detail of what I do as teachers by saying the way out of that is to access the evidence. So I'm confident that if we can get the evidence presented in the right way, well, I'm not only confident, I can see the evidence that more and more teachers want to come to it.
Very interestingly, the medical profession have a journal that's trying to do this called Bandolier, and they deliberately call it Bandolier. Bandoliers being those funny belts with bullets all the way through them, because they see the evidence as putting the ammunition in the hands of the medical practitioners in order to make a really informed professional judgment for each person in front of them. So there's something about seeing it as ammunition that's really helpful, so long as we all make sure the ammunition's pointing at the right things.
Sure.
Okay, let's open this up for discussion. Who'd like to kick off with a comment or a question?
Graham Lane, I used to be chair of the LG Education Committee. There is, for teacher development, the 5 training days. They are extremely unpopular with teachers. They're also unpopular with parents because it means their children are off school at different times. But that is 30 hours possible professional development. What would you do to make them much more meaningful to teachers rather than meaningful to the heads and the administration?
Yeah. It's interesting how they were called the Baker Days, weren't they, Graham, originally, because they were mandated on us. They were a kind of, as you know, they were part of an industrial dispute kind of compromise. But anyway, the problem is that they've become all sorts of things, haven't they? There are some people in there now that do some twilights in order to add up so you get 5 days extra holiday and all sorts. I mean, one of the problems with finding time for professional development, which I am, from my talk, an absolute advocate for, but I want to match that with a challenge that the content itself is worthy and meaningful for teachers. I mean, there's nothing worse than, you know, on a Wednesday afternoon, you've got to then go and sit in the staff room and watch someone's PowerPoint stack as they tell you how
about
the world
independent about learning.
Independent learning, yeah, as you sit and listen to for 2 hours or something like that. So there is something about getting the quality and supply right of professional development. What is it for? What's the purpose? How do we get it informed? How do we make it rich? And how do we make it relevant to individual teachers? But the idea that there are chunks of days and there has to be time for it, it doesn't seem to me that's how professional learning happens. It's much more that on the job, in the moment, on the task, you're supported to improve. So we're running a couple of really interesting trials. One is that you are, as you're teaching, if you choose to, by the way, only, your lesson is being videoed. And you get clips back with annotated kind of reflections on your teaching. Or as you're teaching, you're wearing an earpiece. And I did a year 4 lesson. Of course, you can imagine it was kind of hopeless. But I did a year 4 lesson where someone was talking about my teaching to me while I was teaching these kids. So there are all sorts of new bits of technology that, because we know that feedback, what we're talking about is how do you give a teacher feedback on their teaching to improve their teaching rather than rate their teaching? We know that feedback is strongest when it's given close to the moment of action. So you're trying to find ways of doing that in the run of teaching. We're also doing a wonderful piece of work on lesson study, which has swept through the nation from Japan and Korea and places, and we're doing a big randomised trial of lesson study in the kind of East Anglia region, often forgotten in England. Looking at this is three teachers working together on a particular issue or problem and trying to plan and teach and give each other feedback, how can I improve my teaching? So I think we need to get much smarter about professional development that is truly connected to the business of teaching rather than somebody telling you what you should know and what you should do divorced from the practice. And so I'm not sure about 5 days. I'd like to see more resources that give you opportunities in the day to be freed up, to have someone teach alongside you for coaching on that support rather than, rather than so much being sort of separated from the business.
A metaphor that I sometimes find quite helpful here is if you think about electricity pylons running across the country, the thing you see is the electricity pylon. And that's kind of the equivalent of an inset session, but it's not the point. The point is the professional learning going down the line,
well,
as you were saying.
Also, Philippa, we've got a kind of leadership and management question. So I know we're being filmed, so I'll be careful, but we've got a... That's the issue about being filmed. You kind of find yourself self-censoring. We've got this... we've had a culture of compliance leadership in English education. So one of the unintended consequences of the inspection framework has been a kind of compliance culture. And it's very interesting that moves through the system. So, for example, there's a current madness in English schools of marking going on, which people nod. I can spot the teachers. When I say madness of marking, people start nodding. Because there is this culture abound about marking currently, which is unsustainable and incredible workload on teachers. Where does it come from? The evidence does not point to triple marking every piece of work and all the rest of it. But it's become kind of an idea that this makes you a good school, and Ofsted like it. And then our leaders in our schools are great at making sure everybody does it. So we've got this compliance culture. So there's a challenge to the leaders in our schools about their capacity to help people grow and improve. And that's not in a one day at the end of the week or the 5 days. That's in the daily business of performance management and supporting people.
Sure. But what the evidence would say is that, like the electricity panels, you need a rhythm. You know, the panels are doing a job, and the job of the leaders is to make an environment that structures that and includes progression in it, and so on, and some differentiation. Different teachers.
Yeah. Well, not leadership, it's just compliant leadership.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So, other comments, colleague here.
David Lightman, I'm a fellow here. I'm about to give up 30 years of work in industry to train in the PGC and then become a secondary school teacher. So, without pushing me off, have you got any advice?
tell me what subject you're doing and what.
the much maligned media studies.
So my advice, this is just my own personal, to become a primary school teacher. There is nothing more wonderful in the world than primary education. Because, well, two or three reasons. Become an early years. My first class was a reception teaching. And there's something about the insights in learning, of learning that children give you, which I think is the most important bit of education. I would say that, wouldn't I? But we know if you're interested in tackling disadvantages and social justice and all those issues, we have to get primary right. So 100,000 children left school last year in primary school not reading at level four. Scandal. Scandal. 6 years, reached level four at reading. I think we should all look at ourselves and ask, how's that possible? Of those children, only 1 in 10 go on to get 5 A to C's. You can't turn that round. Deep compensatory behaviours, deep systems get built. So we have to get primary right. If you're going to do secondary, do media studies. No, maybe. It's wonderful. Fantastic. I don't know what advice to give. The advice I would give is absolutely the PGC will support you and that's the right thing to do and in the first year. But in the second and third year, it's finding time to step out and ask and keep engaged and excited about this business of how do children learn? Well, how does anybody learn? That's the enduring inquiry. And that's the one that we need to step back from the day job every now and then to ask ourselves about. But go look at some primary schools as well.
My name's Adrian Ingham. I'm a fellow and former head teacher. Two words that you've used interest me. Compliance, of which I think there is an enormous amount. And the other is evidence. And I think it's very contentious, actually. The evidence, for example, about teaching assistants that emerged from the toolkit has led to a number of schools eliminating teaching assistants who did not have an impact on basic skills. And my belief has always been that teaching assistants are there to offer things that teachers cannot necessarily offer. You talked about it's the place that we are that matters as much as the pedagogy and the curriculum. What have you to say about the reaction of compliant leaders that has led to that result?
Yeah. It's a really good point, Adrian. It's one that... I worry about this, and I'm right to worry about it, because although we're a small organisation at the EEF, we do have a huge responsibility with the way that we talk about evidence and knowledge, and so you're right to ask me about it. I guess there are two things. Whenever I talk to people about the toolkit, I'm very clear it doesn't tell you what will work. It tells you about what worked, what happened in other places. The interesting thing as well is evidence doesn't tell you anything about values. It's one of the evidence is kind of values free. You've got to bring to it, the question is, what do you want to do? So I'm talking to head teachers. I'm talking about evidence, but I'm as much talking about what is it you want to do? What do we want to do with the institution we're responsible for? We've got to stop letting anybody, whether it's me, whether it's a toolkit, whether it's Ofsted, anyone telling you what to do and take, as my word is, responsibility for our own school. Because you're right, under the teaching assistance headline, which is worrying that we spend more than we spend on Sure Start on teaching assistants, 1 in 4 of the profession in primary, we see at the moment quite low impact. Underneath that headline is huge variation of some people delivering massive impact and some people to get to an average of 1 or 0, it's negative. And we have to get underneath that and unravel that. So we've actually just published something which goes further and pulls out evidence out and sets out in much more detail what the underlying evidence is. And we're very interested in not just the experimental studies with the numbers, but the process underneath, the process study. All of our studies have both an experimental report and a process study to get to the story. But that is the horse, and that's the horse, and that's the cart. And we're trying to redress a balance of too many studies in England which are just qualitative and don't have the horse, or have them in the wrong order. So we are redressing a balance. But you are right to say we should be sceptical about it, we shouldn't be cynical about it, we should question it, and we should ask ourselves, what are the values that we're trying to build, and how does the evidence help and support me? That's how I respond to it.
Hi, nice to see you, Kevin. My name's Mohammed Derek Cox. I'm a governor at the Bethnal Green Academy. I can't, and we've known each other a long time, and I'm not going to embarrass you, but the turnover of education in Tower Hamlets a few years ago from being staggering, plodding along, to so many outstanding schools now, And a lot of this started under your watch, and ours happens to be one of them as well. Well, I've got that, if you could answer that one, and I realise that there's a lot of teachers here. What we do a lot of is use an organisation called Teach First to help with the broader base of education. If you've got any comments on that.
Sure. Well, it's so Tara Hamlets, you're right, and it's just been a joy of my life to live there and work there, of course, and I've been lucky rather than anything else. The interesting thing about Tower Hamlets, of course, is it's the poorest place in England. So 58% of the children on free school meals. The national average is, as you know, 20. The next borough in England is 41%. So it's way off the mark in terms of... And yet its performance is above the national average and outperforms every London borough, save Kensington, Chelsea, Hampton, Fulham and Westminster. So there's something interesting going on in Tower Hamlets. And the other thing about Tower Hamlets, of course, is that this is the one I'm most proud of, actually. I'm going back into being Tower Hamlets. Is the lowest performing school in its secondary estate, has the highest results of any council's lowest performing school. There's no good becoming high performing by leaving somebody behind. That's a huge kind of crisis in my view. So our approach was to kind of go like that. And Bethnal Green Tech, as you know, turnaround school, now 80-odd%, amazing story. And it's to do with, it's not to do with, although that is the one secondary school that became an academy a couple of years ago, it wasn't actually about structures. It was about a collegiate approach as a community. And it's interesting, we haven't got time now, but if you take the issue of sensitive and difficult subjects like Holocaust education, we find it difficult to talk about the stuff that's important. We actually find it quite difficult to talk to each other in education. For some reason, we enter into this weird language between, say, an inspector and a head teacher about the business of teaching and learning. And yet we've got on the table in Tower Hamlets a fundamental issue about the of children's sense of belonging and where they are and where they belong and where they're growing up. And we're finding it hard to talk about. A few weeks ago, I was talking to some teachers at Sir John Cass, who are finding it now really difficult to know if they're allowed to talk when the children ask them questions about Syria or about Iraq. How do you talk about it? Because people are shutting down because they're nervous about saying the wrong or right thing. But if children aren't talking to us about it, who are they talking about it? How do we move this forward? So I think there's a whole set of issues where we think we're engaging, but what we're actually doing is closing things down as people become fearful because we don't trust each other to talk about stuff. But the second point, Teach First, it's interesting. People will know about Teach First. It has a huge kind of profile, and I'm a big fan of Teach First. But, you know, we train about 30,000 teachers a year in England, and Teach First trains 1,000. And I'm a fan of Teach First, but I do wish that the media and everybody would turn as much attention to the effort that great institutions are making to train the other 29,000. Because that's the bulk. And also, I don't like, I want to cherish everyone who wants to teach. And I think we need to understand and value everybody. But Teach First has done a brilliant job at detoxifying teaching and doing all sorts of interesting work. But teacher training generally is not a good story. It's not a great success story in this country, and we need to think more about that.
Do you think there are other countries where they're doing it better?
Well, interestingly, Canada has just moved to a 2-year training course, as you know. I'm quite interested in all these routes into teaching. Teach Direct, GTP, Teach First, PGCE. And we need to evaluate it. We need to ask ourselves the question, which route makes you the best? Which is the right route for the right person? How do we kind of... But more importantly, we need to stop thinking that the training of you in that first year... Sorry, David, your PGCE... That is the beginning. That's the end of the beginning of your training. We tend to shut it down at that point and say, all right, you are now a teacher. Go forth and teach. And the life cycle from that moment on is just waiting for you to kind of... It's not a profession that organises that cycle, which I think is an issue.
Now, I want to just pick that up and connect it with something that came up this morning, but just I think it's worth noting before I do, what people may not know is that one of the really cool things in Ontario, at least in Canada, is that if you become a minister of any department, the first thing you have to do is go on a reading evidence statistics qualitative and quantitative evidence course for a fortnight before you get to do any ministering. That's kind of an interesting thought.
Only a fortnight.
Well, it's better than none.
Can't it be 5 years?
Just picking up, there was a really interesting discussion on the table I was at this morning around Holocaust education. Great passion and loads and loads of really detailed, fine-grained examples. Leaders in the schools there were talking about how Holocaust education, teachers coming together to learn about learning through Holocaust education, had in lots of ways contributed to learning about curriculum design, learning about the content and about the how. And one of the things we were advocating was that it should be a case study in every initial teacher education program, not just in history, but in every program. And one of the heads, Beacon Heads, was also talking to us about her concern that she needed more passion and engagement from her maths and her science department. So just interested in your reflections. You've got multiple routes in initial teacher education. It's not a good story. Really fabulous Holocaust education is bringing these disciplines together. Do you think that might help, or what would you see the dangers in that?
I only see dangers if that's not done well. I think it's a subject where or content that deserves huge respect, and I can see that. That's why I worry about it not being taught well. I think there's a potential for all sorts of myths and misunderstandings to abound. So it needs to be done well. But I think my general point is that when teaching is for a purpose, that's when teachers really get excited and come alive. And I think it's sometimes around content. I still think, personally, that teachers are incredibly motivated by the question of social justice in this country and the performance disadvantaged kids, and we need to say, you know, make that a sharp... I think it's great what's happened to Pupil Premium. I think this is now a... We speak about it, we have named it as an issue. We need to address it. We did that in the 1980s with English traditional language. We addressed it, we faced it as a profession, and look what the fantastic turnaround we had with that group of kids. We're now doing it with white working class kids in this country. We need to name the issue, and it is the white working class of England that we need to face as a group of kids and deal with that issue. And we need to deal with it professionally. We need to name and face the issues. And I think that creates purpose. And I think this is true of this content as well. There are a number of bits around we could do that with.
Okay. Colleague at the back and then this colleague at the front.
Hello, Nick Causton from Steamco. Here at the RSA, you'll know we have an agenda, the power to create agenda. And at the moment, there's a polarising debate around Ken Robinson's new book. I saw a blog this morning saying we should ban the word creativity in schools. So I wonder what your thoughts are around whether we're actually teaching creativity out of our children and how we might measure creativity and if we even should.
I'm pretty simple on all that. Guy, really, of course we should talk about creativity. Of course it's a word that's perfectly valid and should be used in my book. It's a bit like, what's the phrase? You need to kind of simplify but not make simple. There's something about, it's like phrases like metacognition. I was working with some teachers last week who were talking about what they were educators of teachers. They were talking about self-regulation, if this is linked to my point, where some teachers in America are now running self-regulation lessons. And it's misunderstanding that history, education has a long and very noble history of understanding that when you give children fantastic things to do and you give them a rich and varied set of experiences, well, lo and behold, they can develop all of the kind of attributes and all of the ways of looking at the world that you want. So I'm more about a broad and balanced, fairly traditional, actually, kind of curriculum, but teaching it really, really well. And I don't see that that creativity, when we teach well, has kind of been lost. And I don't like the idea of separating everything out and making this the purpose and all the rest of it. I think it's keeping it broad and balanced. And I'm a bit old-fashioned that when it comes to primary schools, which is my obsession, I won't take a step back from saying the fundamental thing is we have to get literacy and numeracy right. But there are all roads lead to Rome on that. You know, there's lots of ways of doing that.
Okay.
That's a bit old-fashioned, I guess.
We've got time for one last question. Colleague on the front here.
Hi, we've got a question from Twitter here from Boyo Adam, who asks, innovation seems default in a kind of global setting, but he asks, what's the responsibility for countries where the systems are more rigid in creating innovative systems?
So innovation, I'll just talk about a quick take on innovation. I guess I've been very... you don't get any extra marks in my book because you're doing something that no one's done before. That doesn't give you any points at all. You get points because you've decided to start from what we know and iterate it to make it better. And in fact, I'm sceptical of innovations where people are reinventing education for the first time. I'm much more interested in iterative kind of practice, where we've taken something that works, but we're trying to make it even better. Or we're taking something that isn't working, and we're trying to fix it. So we use the phrase disciplined innovation. I'm not interested in celebrity innovation. We've got a lot of that in education. I'm not interested in innovation for its own sake. I think innovation has to be for a purpose. And I'm interested in innovation, particularly the ones where you are potentially just turning the screw one more notch. But you're doing it in a way that makes it accessible and open to your colleagues and profession. So I'm not interested either in closed innovation. I think the democracy of education is a massive issue about how there is so much new coming through. I think technology has huge kind of potential to widen the gap and to make education even more exclusive, and how we ensure our innovations are democratic and open to all teachers, particularly around the issue of disadvantaged kids, which I think is the biggest single issue we face. But our education system is serving many children well, but it is failing the children who need it most. And we have got to face that issue down.
Well, Kevin, that's just been a wonderful session. It's been a model of high expectations. You've not let us off the hook once. It's always been both and. It's been both and evidence and values and judgment. It's been about great context that really makes sense and is powerful. Therefore, is addressing disadvantage. There's a lot of recognition of the role of Holocaust education in this and the potential for it, but not as an end in itself, not to use it. But I think you're saying to us, start, finish, check yourself. Are we using this? Are we working with it? Are we enabling people to become world citizens in ways that put the building blocks as well as the big picture in place, and that literacy and numeracy are just the most important starting point? It's been wonderful. It's been great fun too. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much, Philippa. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.